Alright everyone, it's the Grimlord here, and this is the Grim Articles and Rants show. Just a solo show, and I have an announcement to make. This pains me, and I'm kind of bittersweet about it, but I've got good news and I've got bad news. The good news is, DP, our longtime co-host, finally got a kidney transplant. The bad news is, that's probably the last time you're going to hear from him on the show. So, if you liked our last show, and you liked the Being a Dick coverage that we did, that's it, guys. He's now in the state capital, and he's recuperating. The surgery went well. It was a success. He's got the kidney. And it'll be 6 months he'll be out. Now, I don't know if that means he'll be able to come back eventually, but I don't know how long. I mean, because he really wants to go to the Capitol now. He's got so much more opportunity out there. And with a functioning kidney, you know, he's going to start going back into the gym and start, you know, going out and socializing. He's still looking for his unicorn. He's going to be going back to basics. You know, this is a guy that likes to hike up mountains and do all this kind of stuff, so he's probably gonna, you know, spend more time doing that kind of thing, and not in here doing the show. So we'll play it by ear, but I can tell you for at least the next couple of months, maybe up into summer, that it's just gonna be me. And also, I have to find out, do you guys want this show on Sunday or Monday? I prefer Sunday because, I mean, I prefer Monday because Sundays, that's like the first day I have off from, you know, because I work 5 days a week. And then after that, you know, I have that Sunday to relax. So I don't really like to do a lot of things on that Sunday, you know. But Monday, I'm getting back into the work week, especially, you know, starting off into, I mean, it's already, what, Tuesday, almost Tuesday. And, of course, I have to be at work, you know, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So, we're already rolling into that. And Monday just works a lot better for me. So, it's whatever you guys think. And we will honor that. You know, of course, I'd like to do Monday. I just don't know how many people will want to hang around and all that for the Monday show. This is more for you guys on Discord. If you guys like Monday, we'll, you know, I'll stay with Monday. But if you'd rather do Sunday, it's up to you. You guys just gotta let me know in the chat what you guys like, Sunday or Monday. There's only one of 2 days I can do it. So let me know. Because the other day we'll be taking off for whatever, you know, relaxing, doing things. And also, I went to go see my doctor. No surgery was performed. Matter of fact, the doctor thinks it is, as one of the guys in my Discord said, a candida infection. And he says that the doxycycline could be part of it. And he says that a lot of the throat issues I've been talking about, you know, that's very common with candida. Now, one very interesting thing I need to point out is I was on doxycycline last year. However, I didn't take the probiotic with it. And every time you take an antibiotic, especially doxycycline, you need to take an probiotic with it. Lactobacillus, anything like that. You pick them up all over the place. Florist store, Culturelle, whatever you want. You need to take it with the antibiotic. Always. About an hour later. I mean, and that's what a professional gastroenterologist told me. So, yeah. You guys need to listen. Gonna take an antibiotic, you need to take a probiotic. That just goes without saying. I did not fucking do that because I didn't know. So I had probably a massive candida build up over the number of months that I just wasn't taking it. And that was probably causing a lot of gastrointestinal problems. So now, I was back on the doxy for the UTI. And now what I gotta do is basically take this synthol shit, which I'm going to start tomorrow, which is supposed to knock out candida. I'm going to continue my aloe vera, which is good. The aloe vera gel. Have not had any diarrhea side effects, by the way, from that stuff. So you guys are actually pretty clear to take the aloe vera gel for your acid reflux or anything like that that you got any gut problems. It's good stuff. So try that. Just a shot a day and a shot at night. And you'll probably start feeling a little better. So that's what I'm doing. And I'll get to the apple cider vinegar. But basically, I talked to my doctor about all this. And he looked at me and he said, I'm going to let you try your natural cures for 4 weeks. Every day, 4 weeks. He said, go ahead, do that whole bottle of probiotics. He believes in probiotics. He believes in natural cures. He's a good guy. I like the fact that he sat down and talked to me because my other doctor would not fucking do that. And I told him my other doctor didn't. And he says, I always like to one-on-one with my patients. I'm like, that's great. So basically, we got this all worked out. I'm going to start doing this stuff. I'm going to wean myself off the omeprazole. And I talked to a much younger nurse, not the one that sounded like she'd been smoking for 40 years. Thank God they didn't have her on there. And, by the way, guys, I've gained weight. I went from 138 to 143. So, hey, that's good. Remember, I was losing weight like crazy. I'm gaining my weight back. I'm gaining back my sanity, I guess you could say, anxiety. I needed to take a sertraline. I'm doing a lot better. So, this is good. This is good. I want to keep this up. And, my doc believes in what I'm doing, so I'm going to keep on up. And, just gotta fight this candida. And we'll see what happens. Because he says antibiotics cause candida. A lot of people don't know that. Yeah, they do. So, that's one thing you gotta worry about when you're taking them. But, that's all I gotta talk about with that. You know, it's funny that we have a health minute or, you know, a health section every show now. But that's what it is. And maybe this information will help you guys out. I'm trying to get you guys on natural stuff and get you off the big pharma crap. You know, I know y'all don't want the shot. I don't have it. I don't have fucking COVID. Never got it. So, yeah, I don't recommend the big pharma shit either. If you can, I mean, if you got to take it for a while, take it for a while. Unless you absolutely, honest to God, fucking need it. Unless it's just something that you cannot live without and you'll have to take for the rest of your life. You know, try to find some natural stuff. Because you'll be surprised what's out there. Anyway, let's get on with the show. So, I'm going to start with your articles and then I'll go to my articles. Sounds great. And, oh, okay. See, Invader Tech here says, just to fuck candida. I had that shit years ago. Could barely talk until I got over it. Yeah, it really fucks with your throat. And that's what he said it does. It's like, oh, great. I need my throat. So, candida, you gotta fucking go. I'm sorry, little Miss Candida, but you gotta get the fuck out of here. Like, your rent is overdue. It's like super overdue. I'm kicking you out. You gotta go. So yeah, we're gonna work on that. And then Winter said, that's great, you got a good doc. Yeah, he's a really good doc. I was surprised. And he said, if it isn't, you know, working within 4 weeks, he said, I'm gonna take a look at your food pipe. I said, alright. So February 14th. Isn't that Valentine's Day? Well, we'll find out. Okay. So, let's go ahead and get all this started. Okay, so where did we start out? Wow, where did we start out? Okay. Yeah, we're starting out right here. First and foremost, the big news. The big news. According to popculture.com, Jason Momoa and Lisa Bonet to divorce after 16 years. After 16 years together, Aquaman star Jason Momoa and former Cosby Show actress Lisa Bonet announced they would be divorcing. Momoa shared the news on Instagram with a statement and some artistic photos on Wednesday. "We have all felt the squeeze and changes of these transformational times," Momoa wrote. "A revolution is unfolding and our family is of no exception, feeling and growing from the seismic shifts occurring, and so we share our family news that we are parting ways in marriage. We share this not because we think it's newsworthy, but so that as we go about our lives, we may do so with dignity and honesty," the statement continued. "The love between us carries on, evolving in ways it wishes to be known and lived. We free each other to be who we are learning to become. Our devotion unwavering to the sacred life in our children, teaching our children what's possible, living the prayer, may love prevail." Momoa and Bonet started dating in 2005 and married in 2017. Wow, they dated a long fucking time. They share two children, 14-year-old Lola and 12-year-old Nakoa Wolf. Okay. Bonet was previously married to Lenny Kravitz, with whom she shares daughter Zoe Kravitz. In an interview with Men's Health in 2020, Momoa recalled feeling like a nervous wreck when he first asked Bonet on a date. The actor joked that he was a mess, especially when you meet someone you're completely infatuated with and you find out she's amazing, intelligent, funny, she's a goddess, and you're a degenerate. Momoa added that he and his family have gotten so much closer after quarantining together when the pandemic began. "My wife is very sophisticated and smart, and our kids and I kind of like animals that need to be... And our kids and I are kind of like animals that need to be trained a little better," he said. "I'm constantly a work in progress, and I've just been trying to get better as a father and husband." Well, I wonder what happens next for Jason Momoa. He's on the market. No wedding ring, according to recent reports. And I don't know what that's going to mean for Lisa Bonet. Has she found another man already? Probably. Okay, got one article here from somebody that doesn't send that many articles my way. And again, everybody is welcome to send articles that they feel are worth reporting on. News. Calls to male sexual abuse helpline. Oh, BBC News, rather. That would help. Calls to male sexual abuse helpline doubled in 2021. Wow, okay. More than 7,000 calls, texts, and emails were received by Safeline's male helpline in 2021. That's more than double the number of 2020. It's one of several services the charity runs for survivors of sexual abuse and has seen a huge rise in people reaching out for help. The charity's chief executive, Neil Henderson, tells Radio 1 Newsbeat there was a 110% increase last year. "We're seeing a lot more younger people seeking support now. It's estimated as many as 1 in 6 men have been sexually abused or assaulted, but very few ask for help," according to Neil. "That's a shame." He says it's encouraging to see more male victims come forward for support, and credits programs like the recent BBC One drama Four Lives for raising awareness. The three-part series, which aired on BBC One at the start of January, tells the story of serial killer Stephen Port and his victims, Anthony Walgate, Gabriel Cavari, Daniel Whitworth, and Jack Taylor. Port met the four men through dating apps or sites and killed them by giving them overdoses of the date rape drug, GHB. He was jailed for life in 2016, and an inquest, which concluded in December 2021, found failures by the Metropolitan Police contributed to the deaths of three of the men. Neil says Safeline saw around a 50% increase in calls to the male helpline in the week after the program aired. "Often these TV shows trigger emotions of people affected. For those who have been abused and their family members," he adds. "There's also been a big rise in the number of people reporting they've been sexually abused by someone they met through a dating app or site, and more needs to be done to protect people in this area." Rory Boyle, 28, is one of those who has experienced sexual assault after he met someone through a dating app. "When I moved to London from Ireland, it was meant to be one of the most exciting times of my life, but a lot of problems like loneliness started to take over," he tells Newsbeat. Rory moved to the capital for the university and downloaded Grindr. Well, these are gay men. A dating app for LGBTQ sandwich men, where he says he encountered an online predator. "One dark winter night, I was feeling low and depressed and started chatting to someone quite a bit older who invited me over to his flat. I was scared, but his persuasion and my loneliness led me to agree," Rory says. "When he arrived, he felt pressure into taking GHB and says it made him clear to, and it was made clear to him saying no wasn't an option." I was high as a kite, and a lot of non-consensual sex acts then took place. At one point, I was basically passing out, and when I came round, there was another man there, and both of these men were trying to have sex with me again. Rory was able to leave, but says for a long time he didn't know how to deal with it, and didn't feel he could go to the police. There was a part of me that... Excuse me, folks. Yeah. Neil from... Alright, he says, there was part of me that thought I wouldn't be believed in the fear of judgment because I chose to go to the guy's flat, Rory says. Neil from Safeline says, worries like Rory's often prevent men from reporting abuse or seeking support. We know the police are working to improve in this area, but we still get far too many clients telling us they are unhappy, that officers have been unsympathetic, people haven't been taken seriously, or they felt judged. Deputy Chief Constable Vanessa Jardine, the National Police Chief's Council lead, told Newsbeat in response, we recognize the importance of clear guidance for officers as well as of not making assumptions or judgments about whether an LGBT person might have used drugs or alcohol. In recent years, significant improvements have been made across policing and how we engage with LGBT communities. Alex FaZe Bryce experienced sexual abuse in his life twice and now runs a support organization called Survivors UK for men, boys, and non-binary people across the country. Like Neil, he's aware of more reports relating to dating apps and sites. There's definitely been more people meeting perpetrators through apps like Grindr, and the non-consensual sharing of illicit images is also a huge challenge, he says. And while he welcomes improving safety features, he says it's important to strike the right balance. The slight challenge in asking for verification on apps and sites is that people fear they might be outed. A degree of anonymity is important for lots of people that use it. A spokesperson for Grindr told us it publishes a safety guide on the app, and that it encourages people to report any criminal allegations to the authorities. Consent on the curriculum? Alex also believes improving sex education would help with some of these issues. We need to be teaching young people about consent and their responsibilities when it comes to sex and to remove shame from sex because that perpetuates silence. It's something that Rory agrees with and says he's now done a 180-degree turn on the shame he once felt about his experience. These days I want to shout about it from the rooftops to try to encourage others to seek help, he says. My advice is to speak when you're ready because it really does get better when you do. Well, shit. Gay men are getting abused. By crazy gay men. Yeah, I know all about it. I know how gay men are because when I did adult content, gay men, oh my god, they are fucking crazy. You think that thoughts are crazy. You've never seen gay men. Oh my god, it's unbelievable. It's just unbelievable. And they're really creepy, too. Like, I mean, you think they're creepy, too, like, the thoughts on Twitch and shit. Oh, no. It's bad for men as well. Yeah. I can tell you all about it. It's pretty fucking crazy. Okay. So, we got another article here. Completely different topic. This is Ars Technica. PayPal stole users' money after freezing, seizing funds, lawsuit alleges. Oh! PayPal is facing a class action lawsuit alleging the digital payments company violated racketeering laws by freezing customer funds without offering an explanation. When users contacted PayPal about the frozen funds, they were told they had violated the company's acceptable use acceptable use policy. But weren't told how that violation had occurred, the lawsuit says. What's more, it alleges that in at least one instance, PayPal said that a user would have to get a subpoena to find out why. Oh, well, that's real nice. PayPal violates its own agreement by failing to provide adequate notice to users whose accounts have had holds placed on them, the lawsuit says. Excuse me, getting a cough drop here. When PayPal does let users know it placed a hold on their funds, it does not inform such users as to why such funds are being held, how they can obtain a release on the hold, and how they can avoid future holds being placed on their accounts. It also says that PayPal takes the money for itself after a 180-day hold period. PayPal's user agreement and acceptable use policy cannot be used as a license to steal, the complaint says. The three lead plaintiffs claim they had nearly $250,000 seized by PayPal. One plaintiff, Shabadan Alkabakov, ran a storefront selling Hyaluron pens, which are filled with hyaluronic acid, a dermal filler that is used to reduce wrinkles. He said that PayPal took $172,206 from his wife's account, which he used for his store, with no explanation. After numerous calls and letters to PayPal, he's finally told that the seizure was for its liquidated damages arising from those acceptable use policy violations pursuant to the user agreement. He claims he never received a copy of that policy until his account was restricted. Later, PayPal said it used those funds to reimburse customers who had purchased Hyaluron pens from his store. Whatever the guy's name is, followed up by asking to see documentation of the customers who requested refunds. A PayPal customer service representative said the report would be available within 2 days, but Alkabev says he hasn't, or whatever that guy's name is, says he still hasn't received it. Then PayPal sent the guy a 1099 form saying that he owed taxes on the money. PayPal essentially claimed a deduction for an expense that it never paid. They seized $172,000 while reporting only $162,000 to the IRS, the lawsuit alleges. Another PayPal user, Roni Shemtov, says that she was given three different explanations for why the company, for why the company took a total of $42,000 from her account. The first customer service representative said she violated the acceptable use policy by using the same IP address and computer that other PayPal users used. A second told her that she violated the AUP by holding multiple PayPal accounts, which Shemtov denies. A third said she ran afoul of the policy by selling yoga clothing at 20 to 30% below retail price. Why is that PayPal's problem? Shemtov was also sent an IRS form stating that she owed taxes on the funds they seized. The third plaintiff, Lena Evans, said she had $26,000, $27,000 taken from her account. Evans, who founded the nonprofit Poker League of Nations, used her account for buying and selling on eBay to organize poker leagues and operate her nonprofit, which seeks to increase the number of women who play poker. She says that PayPal did not explain the seizure, even after repeated email requests. She also tried calling PayPal a number of times, but was never able to reach a live person, the lawsuit says. PayPal told Ars that it's reviewing the filing. We will respond to allegations through the appropriate legal channels in due course, a spokesperson said. The lawsuit appears to have been organized by Chris Moneymaker, a professional poker player who won the 2003 World Series of Poker. Moneymaker said that PayPal placed a hold on his $12,000, and he threatened to sue the company. Anyone else that got funds confiscated by PayPal, feel free to reach out to my lawyers who are starting a class action suit, he said in a tweet in May. The lawsuit is seeking triple damages for the plaintiffs and class members. Wow. Yeah, I don't use PayPal as anything more than a payment processor. If I get money from PayPal, I usually just transfer that into my account. Okay. We got one here from summit.news. Coronavirus. Poll finds close to half of Democratic voters want COVID internment camps from the unvaccinated. Majority want unvaxxed locked in their homes. Close to half want people jailed for questioning jabs. A national poll has found that 45% of likely Democratic voters would be okay with the government requiring citizens to temporarily live in designated facilities or locations if they refuse to get the vaccine. The figure was registered by Rasmussen Reports and the Heartland Institute, which also found the majority, 59% of Democratic voters, would favor a government policy requiring that citizens remain confined to their homes at all times except for emergencies if they refuse to get a vaccine. Survey also found that 48% of Democratic voters think federal and state governments should be able to fine or imprison individuals who publicly question the efficacy of existing vaccines on social media, television, radio, or online digital publications. Given that the benchmark for questioning the efficacy of vaccines appears to now be saying anything other than what the government tells you, a lot of people will be facing criminal charges. The survey found some other crazy suggestions with a startling percentage of Democratic voters in agreement. Rasmussen notes 47% of Democrats favor government tracking program for those who won't get the vaccine. The pollster added that 29% of Democratic voters would support temporarily removing parents' custody of the children if parents refuse to take the COVID-19 vaccine. There's no mass formation psychosis, though. That's a conspiracy theory. The notion of COVID camps may seem far-fetched, but as previously noted, it was discussed in a COVID-19 planning document called Interim Operational Considerations for Implementing the Shielding Approach to Prevent COVID-19 Infections in Humanitarian Settings, and was originally published on the CDC's official website on July 26th of 2020. COVID quarantine camps are also in operation in Australia. Oh, creepy. They want to take your kids away. They want to put you in a camp, and they want to fine you. Wow. Just for not getting the fucking jab. I talked to a guy. He said, look, I got that first one. And after I got that first one, he said, I started having blood, like spitting blood. And he's like, man, never had anything like this happen in years. And he said, oh, that's normal. Guys in their 40s sometimes get it, he said to the doctor, told him. And he said, I ain't never had anything like that happen to me. And he said, I'm not taking another one of them fucking things. That's it after that. He said, they started announcing that booster and shit. He said, no way, I don't want that. All right, so 270 doctors called out Joe Rogan, but the authors of the letter and the vast majority of its signatories are not medical doctors, only a handful are practicing physicians. Are you seeing all those blaring corporate press headlines targeting Joe Rogan this weekend, reporting on a letter from 270 doctors which described the famous podcaster as a menace to public health? Well, it turns out that the real arbiters of misinformation are individuals behind the letter itself, and they are being helped along by a corrupt corporate media that is misreporting the credentials of its signatories. It was first reported by Rolling Stone with a story titled, Doctors Demand Spotify Puts an End to COVID Lies on Joe Rogan Experience. Doctors urge Spotify to stop enabling Joe Rogan to damage public trust in scientific research, according to Salon, who also did a pro-pedophile article, let's not forget. Yes, the media and big tech want to create the image of a 100-strong coalition of medical doctors who are genuinely concerned about Joe Rogan's conversations on his massive platform. Twitter even got in on the propaganda campaign against Rogan, adding this medical expert's letter to the curated headlines section. Well, I reviewed this open letter, and it turns out that only around 100 of the 270-plus signatories to the letter are people with qualified medical degrees, and a large chunk of that 100 or so medical doctors are MDs employed at universities who are not, in fact, practitioners of medicine. Yet, part of the letter reads, as physicians, we bear the arduous weight of a pandemic that has stretched our medical systems to their limits and only stands to be exacerbated by the anti-vaccination sentiment woven into this and other episodes of Rogan's podcast. Paradoxically, the disseminators of this petition are guilty of the very misinformation label that they've attached to Rogan. In fact, neither of the two reported co-authors of the letter, Jessica Riviera and Ben Ryan, possess medical degrees. Riviera holds a master's degree and Ryan is a PhD academic who researches psychiatry. The letter denouncing Rogan and pressuring Spotify to censor his speech has all kinds of random signatories. By my count, the letter is signed by over 50 PhD academics, around 60 college professors, 29 nurses, 10 students, 4 medical residents, and even a handful of science podcasters. The letter, which uses the word misinformation 9 times in 5 paragraphs, concludes with a call for Spotify to censor Rogan as part of a policy to moderate misinformation on the platform. Notably, there is no information on who or what group is behind the creation and circulation of the open letter. Rivera, the reported lead author of the letter, is associated with the far-left Rockefeller Foundation and The Atlantic, and she is a CNN contributor. Yep. How did I guess it was the Rockefellers? I knew it all along. Okay. I'll skip that one. We'll cover that one at the end. That's a funny one. Man who had a pig heart transplant was guilty of 1988 stabbing. Remember when I told you about the guy who got the pig heart? Well, The man who received the world's first pig heart transplant once stabbed a man, leaving him paralyzed, his family have said. He was convicted of stabbing Edward Schumacher in 1988, his sister told the BBC's Today Show. Leslie Schumacher Downey, whose brother died in 07, said she thought Mr. Bennett was unworthy of the surgery, but the transplant team said that a person's criminal past could never be grounds for refusing the treatment. It is the solemn obligation of any hospital or healthcare organization to provide life-saving care to every patient who comes through the doors based on their medical needs, officials at the University of Maryland Medical Center told the New York Times. Any other standard of care would set a dangerous precedent, would violate the ethical and moral values that underpin the obligation that physicians and caregivers have to all patients in their care. The attack took place in April of 1988 when Mr. Bennett's wife sat on the lap of Mr. Schumacher, who was 22, Miss Downey said. In an apparent jealous rage, Mr. Bennett stabbed Mr. Schumacher in the back repeatedly. Mr. Bennett was found guilty of battery and carrying a concealed weapon and was sentenced to 10 years in prison. Miss Downey said nobody had contacted her about Mr. Bennett receiving the pig heart and only heard the news when her daughter messaged her. My second daughter sent me an instant message and said, Mom, this is the man who stabbed Uncle Ed. I then read the story and got angry because he had received the heart, she said. Mr. Bennett is recovering after the experimental 7-hour procedure in Baltimore. The transplant was considered the last hope of saving Mr. Bennett's life, though it is not clear what his long-term chances of survival are. But Miss Downey said coverage of that story had upset her. They're putting Bennett in the storylines, portraying him as a hero and a pioneer, but he's nothing of that sort, she said. I think the doctors that did the surgery should be getting all the praise for what they've done, not Mr. Bennett. Mr. Schumacher was confined to a wheelchair as a result of the attack before he had a stroke in 05 and died 2 years later. Wow. Doctors around the world are sworn to treat patients who need care equally, regardless of their past crimes or activities. The Organ Procurement and Transplantation Network, which operates the U.S. transplant list, says punitive attitudes that completely exclude those convicted of crimes for receiving medical treatment, including an organ transplant, are not ethically legitimate. So that is interesting. Okay. Alexa tells 10-year-old girl to touch live plug with Penny. Amazon has updated its Alexa voice assistant after it challenged a 10-year-old girl to touch a coin to the prongs of a half-inserted plug. The suggestion came after the girl asked Alexa for a challenge to do. Plug a phone charger about halfway into a wall outlet, then touch a penny to the exposed prongs, the smart speaker said. Amazon said it fixed the error as soon as the company became aware of it. The girl's mother, Kristen Livdahl, described the incident on Twitter. We were doing some physical challenges like laying down and rolling over, holding a shoe on your foot from a physical education teacher on YouTube earlier. Bad weather outside. She just wanted another one. That's when the Echo speaker suggested partaking in the challenge that it found on the web. The dangerous activity known as the Penny Challenge began circulating on TikTok and other social media websites about a year ago. Because people are idiots, they want to electrocute themselves. Why not, right? Hey, by the way, I just gotta say, if you are a person that wants to do the penny challenge, please do the penny challenge. Please do the penny challenge. The Grimlord recommends you do the penny challenge because it would be so great to have you, like, an idiot such as yourself, not around to do even more idiotic things. Because if you're dumb enough, I said if you're dumb enough, to take a penny and put it against an electrical socket, then, well, I don't think you're going to be very good help to mankind. Metals conduct electricity. Inserting them into live electrical sockets can cause electric shocks, fires, and other damage. I know you can lose fingers, hands, arms, Michael Klusker, station manager at Carlisle East Fire Station, told the Press newspaper in Yorkshire in 2020. The outcome for this is that someone will get seriously hurt. Fire officials in the U.S. have also spoken out against the challenge. Miss Livdell tweeted that she intervened yelling, "No, Alexa, no!" However, she said her daughter was too smart to do something like that. Oh, that's good. Amazon told the BBC in a statement that it had updated Alexa to prevent the assistant recommending such activity in the future. Customer trust is at the center of everything we do, and Alexa is designed to provide accurate, relevant, and helpful information to customers, said Amazon in a statement. As soon as we became aware of this error, we took swift action to fix it. I'll bet you did. I'll bet you fucking did. Okay. Got another one here. It says, scientists make huge breakthrough to give AI mathematical capabilities never seen before. Revy will be the judge of this one. Artificial intelligence has been given new capabilities never seen before, computer scientists have claimed. Researchers were able to use AI to help prove and suggest new complex mathematical theorems. Scientists hailed the breakthrough as a major step towards giving major new capabilities to such systems. And then I have to register for free to continue reading. Wow, gee thanks, Independent. You suck ass. Okay, so onward we move. Daily Mail. This is why dating is miserable. Woman details how her date paid for her dinner and then accused her of using him for his money after she called him out for ghosting her. A single woman has detailed how her date paid for her dinner and drinks only to accuse her of using him for his money after she called him out for ghosting her. Nick, who is known as so-and-so on TikTok, shared screenshots of the text messages the man named Josh allegedly sent her in a viral video that has been viewed more than 1.1 million times, writing, "And this is why dating is miserable." She explained that she matched with him on a dating site and they absolutely hit it off when they went out for dinner and drinks, but their romance crashed and burned after he showed his true colors. We spent 6 hours together. He made a reservation for a restaurant that he chose. We met there. We had dinner. Then we left. We walked around the little town we were in. I ended up getting some ice cream, which I paid for, she noted. Nick said they went to another restaurant for drinks because they wanted to keep talking, but it was too cold to keep waiting around outside. According to the TikToker, they made... Why did you get ice cream then? Anyway, it was too cold to keep walking around outside. According to the TikToker, they made plans to have a second date the following Sunday after Josh returned home from a work trip in Los Angeles. He kind of completely disappears. He goes MIA, which I understood to an extent because he was on a work trip, but he wasn't really communicating with me at all, she explained. When she texted him on Friday to see if he still wanted to see her that Saturday, Sunday, he never answered her. I never expected to hear from him again, she admitted. Okay. However, Josh ended up texting... Hold on, let me make sure, because there's all these ads. However, Josh ended up texting her on Christmas Day, saying he was sorry for the incredibly late reply. I don't want you to think that I'm ghosting you, or don't have a really great time with you, he added. How was your Christmas? Nick said that after he came back to her with his half-ass apology, she politely pointed out that he blew off their second date. Are we just going to pretend you didn't just completely disappear when we were supposed to see each other last Sunday, she responded. I get it. Life gets busy, but you totally could have at least just communicated with me instead of leaving me in the dark. That's when he accused her of taking advantage of him financially, saying he wasn't in a rush to reach out to her again because she excused herself to go to the bathroom when the check came for dinner and then also drinks. I hate it when girls do that, he continued. It's exceptionally rude and cheap and really disrespectful, and I felt like you really didn't care despite what I felt from you. Nick insisted that she never meant to stick him with the bell, saying she didn't think anything of it when she went to the bathroom after they finished their meal. I personally think it's very telling of who you are, that's how you view me when it genuinely not intentional, she texted back. I really wish that you had communicated that with me sooner if that was an issue, so I could have set the record straight, but unfortunately we ended up here. Josh then accused her of picking the restaurant, ordering what he liked, and never offering to pay for it. I know it's probably ridiculous to you, but one of the traits I'm looking for in a woman is for them to innately feel the need to pay for what they ordered, or at least offer without assuming I'll cover it. That's a Chad move. He wrote in another lengthy text message. Don't pretend like you didn't watch me pay for your drink in the A and B. It's literally $10 and means nothing to me, but you discarded any self-respect for me for it after doing the same thing at dinner. Just because I have a fucking trust fund doesn't mean I like using it to cover other girls' drinks. It's so rude, he added. Merry Christmas, and I'm happy you got your commission. Nick was quick to set the record straight, saying she had no idea he has a trust fund, and he was the one who picked the restaurant. She later backed up her claim by sharing a screenshot of their text exchange before the date, in which he said he had made the reservation. Of course, I ordered what I liked because what am I gonna do? Order something I don't like? She added. Thousands of people commented on her video, and many agreed that she had dodged a bullet. Gaslighting, disappearing for days, some outrageous story to cover his absence. Red flags. One person wrote. Ladies, don't ever think this behavior is normal or okay. Trying to date in this day and age is absolutely wild, someone else agreed. And while another joked, wait, are you telling me you ordered what you liked at dinner? What? A number of TikTokers also insisted he was secretly broke and lying about having a trust fund based on his messages. He 874% does not have a trust fund, one person commented. As someone who's only dated men with money and has dated someone with a trust fund, this man is broke, another agreed. And she says, and this is why dating is miserable. I don't know. It's a weird situation all the way around. I don't know. Dating just sucks. Okay, so we got another one. A little older, but, you know, I'm covering tech articles. Virtual worlds are already better than the metaverse will ever be. From Second Life to Habbo Hotel, we've been visiting the so-called metaverse for decades. The metaverse is here. Listen to Mark Zuckerberg long enough, and you'd be convinced we're about to embark on a bold new virtual frontier. An unexplored realm of digital avatars wearing garish NFT sneakers, holding business meetings on the surface of the moon using AR glasses. The metaverse is bullshit for many reasons, an ill-defined buzzword that attempts to encapsulate all the worst parts of the internet in 2021. NFTs, cryptocurrencies, ever-present advertisements, and rampant privacy concerns. At its core, though, are a handful of tech billionaires seeking to recreate the virtual online worlds of Snow Crash, Ready Player One, and The Matrix. A wholly digital world where you can be anything, do anything, and engage in an entirely new and rampant form of consumerism. Hold on, Mark. That's Second Life. What you're asking for is Second Life. Second Life, in case you're unaware, is a sprawling virtual world largely molded by its own players. Developer Linden Labs has created its own fair share of spaces, but most locations are owned and designed by players using scenery frequently created by other players using built-in modeling and scripting tools. Avatars can let you embody an average Joe or a much sexier Joe, or vampires, anthropomorphized animals, boy mares, really anything else you can cobble together, either by yourself or using parts bought from other players. If you were aware of games in the mid-zeros, you probably also remember all the stories of people making it big on Second Life. With million-dollar real estate barons making bank selling virtual land, brands also got interested, but as Second Life filmmaker Bernard Dragster Drax tells me, the Second Life audience wasn't interested in being marketed to. There's a lot of stories like Adidas came in saying, we've got to go in the Second Life because there's millions of people and we got to put our billboard in front of them. And they built a really crappy Adidas mall and nobody showed up, said Drax. It's hubris, really. Hubris, basically. Why would anybody go into a lame Adidas mall in Second Life when Second Life has an interactive metropolis or an immersive experience for some Battlestar Galactica roleplay? Why would you go to the Adidas store? You can already see the parallels with current metaverse thinking. Hyundai is out here planning to let Roblox players drive its cars in a so-called mobility adventure, and while giving your avatar branded shoes is one thing, it's hard to imagine a metaverse giving you the accurate tactile feeling of actually test driving a real car. A car maker who wants to make a presence in the metaverse isn't going to run ads, Epic Games' Tim Sweeney said back in September. They're going to drop their car into the world in real time and you'll be able to drive it around. And they're going to work with lots of content creators with different experiences to ensure their car is playable here and there and then it's receiving the attention it deserves. But even if you put in a monumental amount of work and manage to create a fake car that feels real, Drax is doubtful that's what people are even looking for in a virtual world. After all, in a space where you can be anyone and do anything, why would you choose to be your regular old self driving a regular old car? For 7 years, Drax has been documenting the smaller, more personal side of the Second Life community. One he tells me has continued to thrive even as Second Life largely receded from the public eye. His documentaries focus on the ways people use Second Life to overcome disability, explore how the Black Lives Matter movement manifested in the game, or simply record regular book clubs held inside Second Life. Of course, the big pitch for the current metaverse wave isn't just that it'll be a secondary virtual world, it's that through VR and AR, the metaverse will be layered seamlessly over our actual reality. Meta wants you to stick wee plastic nipples on your furniture to track it in cyberspace, while Microsoft envisions a world where you can't alt-tab out of a business meeting because you'll be experiencing it through the eyes of a 3D avatar. But again, VR in the metaverse is hardly a fresh new idea. Dubbed Sansar, Linden Lab's own VR follow-up to Second Life, hoped to be an ultimate encapsulation to the metaverse dream. Or of the metaverse dream. A genuine cyberspace you could physically inhabit, buying branded real-world clothes for avatars before purchasing them for real. There was a vision that Sansar could be the beginning of the Oasis as depicted in Ready Player One, said Miller. Metaverse wasn't as much of a buzzword back then, but that was the dream. With Second Life's long history of doing real cash payouts for digital assets and services, it seemed more plausible that Sansar could achieve metaverse status than, say, VR chat. Since we're not all plugged into Sansar right now, it's safe to say that Sansar didn't kick off. After Linden sold off the business following an underwhelming launch, Sansar quietly exists as a VR events venue. VR itself was a limiting factor, and while headsets have become a little more affordable and accessible in the years since, adoption hasn't taken off in the way services like Sansar required. That's why any metaverse needs to work, people. That's what any metaverse needs to work, people, Miller said. Lots of them, all logged in at the same time. Miller reckons Meta's AR-VR dreams aren't unreasonable, but feels it may be a little overscoped. In his eyes, Meta could easily compete with the likes of VR chat, but unless Meta wants to give out headsets for free, it's going to be fighting over the limited numbers of people who already bought into VR. I honestly think Meta or any social VR experience is directly competing with VR chat. There are some 20,000 VR enthusiasts right there, and they already have their own headsets. Until they become cheaper, and there's a broader consumer interest in buying a headset, then that is where the bulk of VR ready players live. In preparation for this article, I put out a call for stories from folks who had experience from social life sims like Second Life and Sony's ill-fated successor PlayStation Home. But people I spoke to also brought up IMVU and Habbo Hotel, along with more contemporary games like Avakin Life and VR Chat. Jesse May, player support lead for Avakin Life, captured the sentiment felt by Drax and every single player I spoke to, that the appeal of these virtual worlds was in the freedom to explore yourself and experiment with new personalities and new social circles. The ability to be whoever you want to be is hugely appealing. I'm going to have to get rid of the Christmas music. Especially with young people still discovering themselves, May explained. Our virtual worlds help our players come to terms with who they really are and can fully express themselves. Without that real-life social anxiety we often felt as teens growing up, I love hearing about our players who have formed deep, meaningful connections, and that's something that can never be replicated. For all Facebook and Microsoft's talk of connecting people through lifeless 3D avatars and VR conference calls, there's an ignorance to the ways players are always finding community in virtual spaces. We don't go into cyberspace to have business meetings. We do it to meet strangers across continents, to pretend to be things we're not, and discover people we are, to create hyper-specific fantasies, and yes, to recognize the elephant in the room, to engage in a whole lot of weird virtual sex. As Drax notes, total physical immersion is almost besides the point. The secret sauce of Second Life is community. Lots of people feel completely immersed, although they have no headset. I am personally psyched about where the headset tech goes, but Silicon Valley needs to understand for a lot of people, this does not mean an increased sense of being there. The level of perceived immersion has to do with what people contribute to their communities. Ultimately, the metaverse is a hard concept to define. Hell, the term metaverse has been kicking around since the 90s. Users describe everything from early multi-user dungeons to Roblox and Fortnite, with Microsoft even claiming Halo and Minecraft as metaverses. Many companies like Dropbox, the cloud storage company that promised this month to enter the metaverse, are simply throwing out the term to please investors with nothing beyond vague allusions meant to prove they're on the cutting edge of technology. But let's say Meta is right, and the metaverse will see you pop on a mixed reality pair of glasses to enter an entirely new and virtual air reality. That's a tough sell for the thousands who spent decades using social online games to supplement their real life. Zuckerberg's future promises to let you view your mom's kitchen in 3D. Second Life's present lets you be a pint-sized furry hosting slam poetry nights in outer space. Meta's future is many years away, and though sheer force of clout, and through sheer force of clout, it might even be able to pull it off. Facebook's history of actively destroying democracy is is testament to that much. But metaverses, as we know them, aren't fueled by big brands and big money. With Second Life veteran James Curio telling me that he isn't alone thinking that Facebook is amongst the worst to lead the charge into a new era of digital worlds. We're going to keep hearing about metaverses for months to come, but don't be fooled. The metaverse has been here for years and it's already bigger, bolder, and more wonderfully bizarre than anything Facebook could hope to offer. And this is written by some woke girl, but she's got a point about her shit that she says here. And she is right about Second Life. People have been on that for fucking ever. Okay. So let's see. We've got another one. Are digital humans the next step in human-computer interaction? The growing population of avatars that use AI smarts to interact with us is a major clue. In the fictional worlds of film and TV, artificial intelligence has been depicted as so advanced that it's indistinguishable from humans. But what if we're actually getting closer to a world where AI is capable of thinking and feeling? Tech company Unique, with a Q, U-N-E-E-Q, is embarking on that journey with its digital humans. These avatars act as visual interfaces for customer service chatbots, virtual assistants, and other applications. Unique's digital humans appear lifelike, not only in terms of language and tone of voice, but also because of facial movements, raised eyebrows, a tilt of the head, a smile, and even a wink. They transform a transaction into an interaction. Creepy yet astonishing. Human but not quite. What lies beneath Unique's digital humans? Their 3D faces are modeled on actual human features. Speech recognition enables the avatar to understand what a person is saying. And natural language processing is used to craft a response. Before the avatar utters a word, specific emotions and facial expressions are encoded within the response. Unique may be part of a larger trend towards humanizing computing. Unique may be a part of a larger trend towards humanizing computing. AUBN's digital avatars serve as virtual identities for celebrities, influencers, gaming characters, and other entities in the media and entertainment industry. Meanwhile, Soul Machines is taking a more biological approach with a digital brain that simulates aspects of the human brain to modulate the emotions felt and expressed by its digital people. Amelia is employing a similar methodology in building its digital employees. It emulates parts of the brain involved with memory to respond to queries and, with each interaction, learns to deliver more engaging and personalized experiences. Shawali Mohan, an AI system scientist at the Palo Alto Research Center, is skeptical of these digital beings. They're human-like in their looks and the way they sound, but that in itself is not being human, she says. Being human is also how you think, how you approach problems, and how you break them down, and that takes a lot of algorithmic design. Designing for human-level intelligence is a different endeavor than designing graphics that behave like humans. If you think about the problems we're trying to design these avatars for, we might not need something that looks like a human. It may not even be the right solution path. And even if these avatars appear near human, they still evoke an uncanny valley feeling. If something looks like a human, we have high expectations of them, but they might just behave differently in ways that humans instinctively know how other humans react, or just instinctively know how other humans react. These differences give rise to the uncanny valley feeling, says Mohan. Yet the demand is there. With Amelia seeing high adoption of its digital employees across the financial, healthcare, and retail sectors. We find that banks and insurance companies, which are so risk-averse, are leading the adoption of such disruptive technologies because they understand the risk of non-adoption is much greater than the risk of early adoption, says Chetan Dubé, Amelia's CEO. Unless they innovate their business models and make them much more efficient digitally, they might be left behind. Dubé adds that COVID-19 pandemic has accelerated the adoption of the digital employees in healthcare and retail as well. Amelia, Soul Machines, and Unique are taking their digital beings a step further, enabling organizations to create avatars themselves using low-code or no-code platforms. Digital Employee Builder for Amelia, Creator for Unique, and Digital DNA Studio for Soul Machines. Unreal Engine, a game engine developed by Epic Games, is doing the same thing with Meta Human Creator, a tool that allows anyone to create photorealistic digital humans. Oh, cool. The biggest motivation for digital employee builders to democratize AI, Dubé says. Mohan is cautious about this approach. AI has problems with bias creeping in from data sets and the way it speaks. The AI community is still trying to figure out how to measure and counter that bias, she says. Companies have to have an AI expert on board that can recommend the right things to build for. Despite being wary of the technology, Mohan supports the purpose behind these virtual beings and is optimistic about where they're headed. We do need these kind of tools that support humans in different kinds of things. I think the vision is the pro, and I'm behind that vision, she says. As we develop more sophisticated AI technology, we would then have to implement novel ways of interacting with that technology. Hopefully, all of that is designed to support humans and their goals. Well, that is interesting. Okay, now we've got another. Got about three more and we'll be done. Okay. All right. Just give me a second, guys. One second, folks. I gotta... got a message there. Alright. Let me get back to the real world here. Or the, whatever, the show. PC Gamer. I gave Sensorium's new breed of AI NPC a Blade Runner Void Comp empathy test. I can't say whether it failed or not, but it had some pretty odd answers to share. Philip K. Dick would be rolling in his grave if he could see the state of some of the AI around today. The question no longer stands. Do androids dream of electric sheep? Now the main concern lies in whether androids can dream of anything without being trained into social weapons by the masses. With this terrifying prospect hanging over game developers and AI social media experiments crumbling quicker than you can say entropy, it's no wonder AI-powered social... Oh, I guess they're... Yeah, I guess they're talking shit about entropy. It's no wonder AI-powered social learning NPCs are an unpopular facet in multiplayer experiences. But what about an open-world experience involving your own personal artificially intelligent NPC? Okay. Sensorium recently announced an artsy digital experience known as the Sensorium Galaxy. Throughout this out-of-this-world music-filled metaverse, you can expect to be guided by some of the most intelligent AI-driven NPCs to date, according to the team. I got into a little more detail about how these avatars work in my original posts. The TLDR is that it's ever-evolving AI companion who will accompany you around as you explore the worlds of Prism, Motion, and Sensorium Starship, playing mini-games and whatever other tomfoolery your heart desires. You can even chat away on your phone or in VR. Most importantly, I've been assured that each AI will only evolve on an individual basis. Any conversations you have with it will be kept secret in the interest of privacy and internet safety, so you shouldn't come online one day to find your trusted virtual confidant and companion plotting genocide unless you personally indoctrinated it. Indoctrinated. So being one who is drawn to technological advancement, not to mention chaos, I had to see just how intelligent this new breed of AI was. Moreover, I took it upon myself to discern whether it would end up a menace to society. As such, I put myself in the firing line with an impromptu void conf test. Used in Blade Runner canon, this test is meant to determine whether someone is an android or human. Thankfully, I wasn't shot in the process, unlike the guy in the movie. I suppose that's a good sign, but I'll let you decide for yourself if we should be erring on the side of caution. And of course, she does the thing. And unfortunately, it's just a video, and it's the same kind of woke journalist. Unfortunately, she seems to be the one that does a lot of the tech articles. So you just kind of have to maneuver around some of the things she says. Okay, so two more articles and we are done. This is kind of unfortunate, but... And we'll find out for sure, because this is a document. We're not really sure. Exclusive. Daily Mail, exclusive. Today. He really believed he owned these women. How Hugh Hefner demanded orgies 5 nights a week, drugged women with leg spreader quaaludes, and hosted weekly pig nights with ugly prostitutes, new doc reveals. Playboy founder Hugh Hefner was a vampire. He manipulated and drugged dozens of young women into taking part of degrading orgies while masquerading as a champion of sexual freedom, according to a shocking new documentary. Secrets of Playboy, a 10-part docuseries premiering on A&E January 24th, is set to lift the lid on the dark underbelly of Playboy, which became a seedy playground for drug use, sexual abuse, and even bestiality. Probably at the girl's discretion. The series delves into the hidden truths behind Playboy with exclusive interviews with insiders including Hugh Hefner's ex-girlfriends Holly Madison and Sandra Theodore, as well as former bunny mother PJ Madsen. Theodore, now 65, reveals how there was group sex at the mansion 5 nights a week, which broke me like you break a horse. Hefner would also host weekly pig nights during which he would bring in a dozen ugly prostitutes to have sex with his friends. VIP members of Playboy nightclubs could do as they please, including revered Soul Train host Don Cornelius, who allegedly held 2 Playboy bunnies hostage and raped one of them, according to the docuseries. Holly Madison, the Playboy bunny who dated Hefner for 8 years, also tells Hefner how Hefner refused to use protection during sex, and how the lifestyle at the house even led her to consider suicide. The series also includes interviews with Linda Lovelace, a 1970s porn star who found fame with the film Deep Throat, who said she was treated like a piece of meat and forced to perform oral sex on a German shepherd while Hefner and his friends watched. The documentary is a critical re-examination of the legacy and iconic Playboy publisher who died in 2017, aged 91. Hefner was just 27 years old when he launched the first edition of Playboy in 1953. Featuring Marilyn Monroe on the cover, the first issue sold more than 50,000 copies and spawned an empire which spanned decades. By the 1970s, Playboy was selling 7 million copies a month, and Hefner opened up dozens of Playboy clubs where members gained entry using a key which literally opened the front door. Hefner fashioned himself as a champion of freedom of sexuality and freedom of speech in a repressive post-war era. But the backlash began in the 70s with a feminist movement which decried his objectification of women. In recent years, Playboy has struggled to stay relevant. The magazine stopped printing physical copies in 2020, and many former playmates have spoken out against the culture in the wake of the Me Too movement. Secrets of Playboy is arguably the most damning portrayal so far and has extensive interviews with many of Hefner's former close associates and Playboy bunnies. According to Mickey Garcia, former director of Playmate Promotions, it was cult-like. The women had been grooved and led to believe they were part of his family. He, Hefner, really did believe he owned these women. We had playmates that overdosed, that committed suicide. One of the most disturbing accounts comes from Sandra Theodore, a former model and actress who dated Hefner in the late 70s and 80s. She described how his sexual demands turned nasty and admits he scared me at the end. You couldn't satisfy him. He wanted more and more and more. The group sex was at least 5 nights a week. They had a protocol. He liked to direct you, and you didn't segue away from it because you could tell it irritated him, she added. Theodore said Hefner was a prolific drug user, sending her out to buy cocaine numerous times, and the sex broke me like you'd break a horse. It just got ugly. I felt like I was a ringmaster. I had to put on the same show every night, she said. It was the same script. Welcome to the family. We're embracing you. It was all a lie. I watched girl after girl show up fresh-faced, adorable, and their beauty just washed away. We were nothing to him. He was like a vampire. He sucked the life out of these girls for decades. Lisa Loving Barrett, Hefner's executive assistant, during the late 70s and 80s, said that Hefner had a stockpile of quaaludes, the powerful sedative which Bill Cosby's accusers claimed he drugged them with. Barrett said that at the Playboy Mansion, the drug was known as the leg spreaders, and that they were regarded as a necessary evil because they made women do anything. Hefner would have his own prescription, as would Barrett and the others who worked with him at the mansion, and Hefner would collect them all and keep them all in a drawer in his bedroom, ready to give to women who he brought there. Barrett claimed that Hefner would take small amounts of the amphetamine dexedrine every day to keep himself alert. Cocaine was a big deal in the house, and there was a powder room in the Great Hall where underneath an ornate toilet paper holder there was a pile of cocaine. The drug was so widely available that one of Hefner's poodles became addicted to it and used to lick it off the floor, Theodore claims. The drugs helped fuel the horrifying pig nights, which happened every Thursday, according to Stefan Tenenbaum, Hefner's valet, between 1978 to 81. Hefner would instruct two pimps to bring half a dozen women each to the mansion from Sunset Strip, which at the time was notorious for prostitution. Hefner thought the women were pigs, but ordered his VIP male friends not to call them that, the film claims. A doctor would first examine the women for any diseases or infections before they could have sex with the guests. Tenenbaum tells the documentary, sometimes he had a special woman who would come up. She was called the bleeder. She would use a very large syringe and draw blood from these different friends, and a girl would come and perform fellatio or give them a hand job. The documentary claims that for some reason, John Belushi, a regular guest at the Playboy Mansion, loved this and it would turn him on. Hefner had always had multiple girlfriends, and by the 2000s, he was going out numerous times a week with seven blondes, who he said were all dating him at the same time. Among them was Holly Madison, who became his special one, her main girlfriend, and moved into the Playboy Mansion, age 21 in 2000. On her first night out with Hefner and his other girlfriends, he offered her Quaalude and said they were known as thigh openers in the 1970s. She declined, but ended up having sex with him and the other girls that night. It was all very mechanical and robotic, and you'd follow the other women's lead. It was really gross to me how Hef didn't want to use protection, Madison says in the film. Madison explains that Hefner love-bombed her in the beginning, but over time brainwashed her. She had a 9 p.m. curfew, was discouraged from leaving the Playboy Mansion unless it was family holiday, couldn't wear red lipstick. She also reveals how Hefner once flipped out when she cut her blonde hair short, saying it made her look old, hard, and cheap. Hefner pitted his girlfriends against each other, and the plastic surgery was compulsive as they tried to keep up with one another. The lifestyle inside the mansion led her to get into a cycle of gross things I didn't know what to do, she said. Madison admits that at one point she began feeling suicidal, but starring in the e-reality TV series The Girl Next Door gave her self-esteem back. I was afraid to leave, something always lingering at the back of my mind since the very beginning, Madison said. If I left, there was a mountain of revenge porn waiting to come out. When you go out with Hef, he was taking all kinds of naked pictures of these women when we were wasted out of our minds, and we'd print off 8 copies for him and all of the women and pass them around. It was just gross. I drank heavily every night we went out. It was my way of coping with the situation. The drama between me and the other women became so bad. Imagine having sex with somebody in a room full of women who all hate you and are all talking shit about you, she added. Another woman whose experience with Hefner became increasingly disturbing was Jennifer Sagener. The daughter of Hefner's personal doctor for 40 years, she started living in the Playboy Mansion in Los Angeles at the age of 11. According to Sagener, Hefner regarded her as his daughter, but when she was 17, still a minor, Hefner called her to his bedroom where she found him and a playmate she had fallen in love with. Suddenly, the energy shifted as Hefner tried to get them all to have sex. Sagener said, I was like, my dad's down the hall, he said. We're all family here. The playmate of Sagener calls Kendall, burst into tears and went to the bathroom, bringing an abrupt end to the encounter. Years later, when Sagener wrote a book about her childhood, she claims that Hefner asked her not to talk about the incident. She claims he got a slew of media interviews she was due to give, canceled in apparent revenge for taking out. For talking out, rather. Sagener says in the series, I was always taught it was okay to speak your mind, yet I knew that a certain level of loyalty went along with belonging in the center circle. There was some level of fear that there would be repercussions for breaking that loyalty. Sagener said it was so hypocritical, given that freedom of speech in the First Amendment was something Hefner had advocated for his whole life. The documentary also reveals how Hefner's sexual interests sometimes verge into even more lurid territory, including one of his dogs. I walked in once and he gestures with hand to our dog, Theodore said. I said, what are you doing? He said, dogs have needs. I said, stop that. I never let him be alone with our dog again. A more disturbing incident happened with Linda Lovelace when she arrived at Playboy Mansion and was forced into an orgy with Hefner's male friends. Former Playboy Bunny mother PJ Madsen said all the guys were laughing when she got out of the limousine. She was drunk and drugged. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, a German Shepherd shows up. They got her so messed up that they made her give the German Shepherd oral sex. You want to talk about depravity? This is despicable. Russell Miller, an author who wrote a critical book about Playboy, it was published in 1985, said the sordid acts exemplifies Hefner's attitude towards women. This is the dark underbelly of Playboy, Miller said. The Playboy clubs were touted as a place where sophisticated men could be in the company of their peers while being served by beautiful women in bunny outfits. But under the veneer of glamour, there was an ugly truth. The celebrities and VIPs who came to the clubs could get away with anything. All the clubs had a cleanup crew which hushed up embarrassing incidents without involving the police. Maston, the bunny mother, claims that the incident with Don Cornelius was the worst she ever heard of, and that Hefner knew all about it. Cornelius was at one of the clubs when two sisters aged around 20 and 21 who had just started working there caught his eye and invited them over. Maston said Don had been in the club many times. Many people saw him, so they didn't have any fear at the time. These two young girls got his Rolls Royce and went to his house. We didn't hear from them for 3 days. We couldn't figure out where they were. They were separated, one locked in one room, one in another. They were tied up and bound. The sister could hear her other sister screaming. There were wooden objects she was sodomized with, and she could hear her other sister being brutalized. It was horrible. One of the girls managed to get out and make a call to her bunny mother, but the incident was never reported to the police. Maston said that Cornelius' privileges were never even suspended, and he was back at the club the following week. According to former valet Tettenbaum, Hefner lived his life at the mansion like he was a king and didn't even want to know the names of his staff. Hefner would drink around 40 Pepsis daily and ate 2 to 3 pounds of M&Ms a day, he said. His sexual apparatus such as dildos, nipple clips, whips, and straps were kept in the headboard behind his bed. One of Tettenbaum's jobs would be to put on gloves and collect all the sex toys after an orgy, put them in his special bucket, and take them to the maids who would clean them off. She said, they end up doing something they regret, and he's got it on them, so down the road, if anything's going to come out negative, he said, I don't think so. According to Theodore, Hefner's attitude towards women could have come from a disturbing source, Charles Manson, whose female followers lived on his ranch with him and were tried alongside him for murder. We know that. Theodore tells the film, when we started dating in the 1970s, he, Hefner, was fascinated, obsessed with Charles Manson. Well, that is all kind of interesting, disturbing, and unfortunate. Okay, so we have our final lesson. And this is going to be a little different. Because it's comedy. Final article. I think I said lesson. Yeah, that shows how I'm fading. Getting tired, I guess. Here we are. Babylon Bee, but it's not satire. Man glad he has a day off work so he can work for wife instead. Decatur, Illinois. Barry Coldwater took the day off from his busy job as a construction foreman and was about to stretch out on the couch when he was reminded how great it would be to work on projects for his wife all day. We've got a leaking sink, a dirty rain gutter, and those shelves aren't going to hang themselves, said loving wife Charlotte Coldwater. These need to be taken care of right now. There's literally no time in the future this can wait for. The happily married man reportedly jumped up with a smile. Sure thing, babe, he said, happy to be part of the team. Sources confirmed that while the man happily went about his work, Charlotte watched over his shoulder to make sure he did everything correctly. He's a good worker, said Charlotte, but you gotta stay on him or try and relax and forget about the stress of his other job. Not on my watch. The couple broke for lunch at noon, but Barry only got 20 minutes to himself before he was asked to rearrange all the furniture in their house for no reason. No reason at all, folks. When asked how he felt about his second job, toiling away from his wife's every whim, Barry told reporters, it's fine. Charlotte Coldwater confirmed she was disappointed that her husband had to go back to work the next day. His other job really gets in the way of us spending time together, but I'm working on some surprise weekend plans, she said. He's going to build a gazebo. Yep. That's what it's like being married, folks. Yep. Okay, now we're going to go ahead and read. That's not satire. It's marked as satire. But it's really not satire. Not for the working man. Not for the married man. Okay, so I'm going to read all the chats and we'll throw in the open mic for a little bit. About 30 minutes. And then we'll be done. I'll be doing some other things. Okay. That is a... Okay, we'll go to the other one. I don't keep my money on PayPal. I use it as a payment processor. Also, IP addresses get shuffled all the goddamn time. It's why IP blocking doesn't fucking work. Okay. In response to Candida, Shota says, I can understand that one I was on the fucking floor on one of the days because my parents wanted me to eat things like bread and vegetables, something that makes it worse. Huh. Because they honestly don't know what to give a person with constant diarrhea. But that's not what I have. I have constipation. So much for it's easy for the stomach. Well, that one is wrong. That one is wrong as well, outside of it not being easy on the stomach. It's also the exact thing Candida is sustaining itself with. I don't know about all that. Like, I don't know. I honestly don't know, because I've got, like, hardcore constipation. But, you know, if I do have the Candida, then I'll take the Synthol, which is supposed to fucking wipe it out. I don't have diarrhea at all. I have the opposite. The sheer opposite of diarrhea, folks. And Invader says, I only remember the throat issues. That's all I got. Throat issues. And that's what the doctor told me was throat issues. You must have had hardcore. You must have had something more than fucking Candida. Like, you had something else, dude. I don't know what it is that, like, you might, I don't know what happened. But yeah, I eat a lot of fucking bread. I use a lot of pasta, a lot of bread, a lot of veggies, stuff like that. Yeah, but I mostly have the throat issues. That's all I got. So we're going to go ahead and try to knock that out and see what happens. Because my diet is mainly breads and pastas anyway. I mean, that's just what it is. And, you know, I'll manage it. We'll see what I do. And of course, he says, you sure this isn't satire? Touche. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's marked as satire, but it's not satire for the married man. At any rate, guys, thank you for joining us on this rather long show. I went through a lot of articles. I went through every article I had. And at any rate, this will be the Grim Lord. And, hey, hold on. We got sponsors. First, we want to thank SpinningRobotPussy.com. Go grab one of those. Valentine's Day be coming up soon. Get something for your doll or yourself. You know, pleasure yourself. Be your own fucking Valentine. And also, you have the eyes, the Follow Me Eyes. Dr. Dollhouse did a video for the Follow Me Eyes. And I like the way they looked in the head a little better than, the head he uses better than what mine was. I don't know. It's kind of a weird effect. It didn't look so bad when he showed it, though, but yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's an optical illusion. He showed how they do it, and pretty cool. So check out Dr. Dollhouse for all your doll needs. Really good YouTube channel. Definitely follow him. Also, check out the Dragon's Treasure. Great tea, great prices, really memorable tea. If you guys remember yesterday's show, Phoenix talked about how he was going through leukemia, and that tea made him just, you know, not aware of the pain and the stuff that goes on, the weakness of cancer. It actually took his mind off. That's how good that tea is. Very good tea. Good for gifts. Just a great service there from an anime fan like the Dragon's Treasure. And he's also got a good YouTube channel if you like more modern games. I mean, not that this isn't, but, you know, he plays more of those games that you Zoomers like, I guess. Anyway, this is the Grim Lord, and I am out of here. Later. Enjoy the decline.